are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 12th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist Timothy Faust on his book, Health Justice Now, Single Payer and What Comes Next. Also on the program today, Jeffrey Epstein dead. His apparent suicide shrouded in questions and mystery. Also on the program today, Trump administration continues its assault on the administrative state and on immigrants. The administration announces new rules to limit so-called legal immigration. Meanwhile, the Trump administration weakens protections for endangered species. The Trump EPA will not allow Monsanto to put cancer warnings on their labels for Roundup because it's fine.
Free market.
Meanwhile, new information about EPA's supposed scientific reversal, which allowed the Pebble Mine to cause, quote, a complete loss of the habitat of the largest U.S. fishery in the country, I guess.
Oops.
Oops.
Is that bad?
Meanwhile, dozens of arrests over the weekend as protests against ICE in New York and D.C., including Jews celebrating Tisha B'Av. A conservative wins the Guatemalan presidency based on a repudiation of the Trump safe third country deal. And good news, that Russian radioactive explosion turns out not to be a missile, just a small nuclear reactor. China claiming the Hong Kong protests are terrorist-y. And sadly, Trump's ritzy Hamptons supporters claim they have to hide in the metaphorical closet. Instant analysis? Good. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the show. It is another week in this era of great malaise, ladies and I mean, I'm not going to be, you know, they talked about Jimmy Carter's administration or his era as being one of malaise. And I was, I guess, about 13 or 14 at that time, maybe 12, you know, at by the end of the administration. So I don't know that I really was fully conscious of a malaise per se. And maybe malaise is not the word, but severe depression, like emotional, like malaise, you know.
It kind of implies like an ailment of the privileged to me.
The malaise?
Yeah, like the 90s, everyone's so disaffected, right? They felt malaise because they were like bored.
Well, I'm talking about the Carter era was specifically considered, there was specifically a Carter malaise, and I doubt that was referring to just the elite at that time. But we definitely have a malaise of sorts in this era. And
how many closets does the average Hamptons home have?
I would say so many that, like, I think hiding in the closet in, you know, for these Hamptons people, I feel like would be the functional equivalent of like our vacation.
I feel like Malaise has been upgraded to horror for most people these days.
It's possible.
Like, I miss the Malaise.
Right. Malaise is just a lot. I think probably just, yeah, you could deal with that.
You know what song was number one during the Malaise speech? Blondie, Heart of Glass.
There you go.
Yeah.
It's a good song.
Good song.
Fits the times, too.
There you are. With that said, we'll do our best. Thank you for joining us. Brendan and Michael are not with us today. Brendan will be back tomorrow. I don't know when Michael. Michael's gone on the lam, I guess. That's the problem. He feels a little cash in his pocket, and all of a sudden now he's jet-setting. I don't know if he's like in the UAE right now, or where is he?
Probably.
It's like Carmen Sandiego.
With your help and your membership at jointhemajorityreport.com, I will follow him around on his private jet. Jointhemajorityreport.com to check it out. Let's go into this sound. As you know, there's a big Iowa. It was very big. The Iowa County Fair was happening. I am a big goer of county fairs. I go to the Dutchess County Fair. I go to the Columbia County Fair when I can. I've been to others. Those are the ones that I regularly go to, and tons of fun, funnel cakes, a lot of fried dough type of stuff, rides. Kids like it. I like it too. See a lot of sheep, see a lot of cows, see a lot of horses, pigs. And in Iowa, of course, this is where the politicians go. Not for nothing. On Thursday, this is from Edward Isaac Dovier, I think is how you pronounce his name. He writes for The Atlantic. On Thursday, when he was second candidate to speak at Iowa Fair, this is a tweet, Biden said, "What do you think? Anybody draw a bigger crowd? Don't be a wise guy." And then people who have drawn bigger crowds since then, in rough order, Warren, Sanders, Harris, Booker, with Klobuchar and Gillibrand about even. So
I heard Kamala's middle class tax cuts aren't the applause line she was hoping them to
be. Oh, is that right? Yeah. At Iowa? I mean, it's interesting. I don't know what you can gain from that, garner from that. I mean, the reason why there could have been, apparently Cory Booker gets really big crowds, but it's not showing up in the polls. My guess is that the reason why Joe Biden doesn't get big crowds is because you either have no interest in him or you don't want to know why you're voting for him. And you want to go check out your number two and three possibles. But who knows? We will see in time. But there has been a couple of stories like this where Republicans, because it's just because you have Democratic candidates there, doesn't mean that, yeah, obviously there's Republicans there as well. And they still do their straw polls for what it's worth. And I've seen a couple of stories like this where a Republican family says, "I will not vote for Donald Trump." And then a lot of it is, as long as the Democrats just need to give me someone I can vote for. Well, here's an idea. Just don't vote. If you voted for Trump last time, I got a solution for you. You let Democrats do what they want to do. You just don't vote. All right. Because you people brought this upon us as a country when you voted for him. And if you don't like him now, here's my suggestion to you. Don't tell Democrats who they should nominate. Just don't vote.
Just go home after work.
Yeah, go home. Take the day off. Or if you really want to complete your civic duty, go in, vote for the most local race you can find, and then none of the above for the rest.
A lot of people did do that last time around.
They did. They left. Yes, but they a significant number of those, I think, were Democrats, too. I'm suggesting Republicans only this time. But here is an interesting exchange on MSNBC where it's consistent with our story of which we will maybe get to some of the quotes of the folks in the Hamptons, who which is a ritzy area of Long Island in the summer, who don't have the freedom of speech to say that they like Donald Trump if they want to continue to sell their tchotchkes to people. And so here is this exchange from MSNBC.
in which people get to put in a corn kernel for which candidate they support. I want to let you hear directly from him what he told me.
Pause it. Now this is the way they do their straw poll is actually a corn kernel poll promoting corn. Corn, of course, is heavily subsidized by the U.S. government.
Yeah,
this is a decision.
Corn needs the help.
Right. This was in Iowa, they wanted to push it as much as they can. Corn started with subsidized starting in 1972 when the Commerce Secretary had a plan to create more disposable income in the pockets of Americans. And so the idea was subsidize corn, and then we got to put in all our food, and which is why we are unhealthy. But go ahead.
You put in your corn kernel?
Yes.
Who did you put it in for?
Yes. Huh? I'm white, old. They call me all kinds of names.
And so
who do you think I would vote for? Come on. You're smarter
I'll
than
I'll let you
that.
Fill in the blank.
Yeah. No, I don't have to fill in the blank. Everybody knows. Oh. We're the bad people.
What do they call you?
I'm a racist. I went to school. I shared my dorm with a colored guy. I have nothing against him. I grew up in the East. We grew up with people.
Do you think the president's a racist, though?
No, I don't. I really don't.
When you hear send them back, when you hear him talk about communities of color, do you see why people do call him a racist?
Yes and no, because some of those people he's talking about have said just as bad things about him that you can't say on TV.
Casey, you've been to many state fairs, and I know most of the folks that are on your panel have as well. And the conversations this year just, frankly, are not the same conversations that I've had in years past. And this goes beyond the speeches on the soapbox of these candidates. This goes to the heart of these conversations with voters. And I got to tell you, these are tough conversations to be had because you're talking to people about divide in friendships, divide in family. You're talking about racism and white supremacy. This is no ordinary conversation taking place.
Yeah, it's great. There's a nice conversation taking place there.
It's awesome.
It doesn't sound like it's a conversation.
I mean, it sounds like that guy is outnumbered at Thanksgiving now.
Yeah, it does. And he's a little bit defensive about it.
It's his grandkids' fault that he's voting for Trump.
That's right.
At least they're getting to him.
I mean, the real question at that time, it seems to me to be asked, is like, why are you voting for Trump? Like, what is it that he feels Trump is doing for him? In terms of, I mean, we know farmers are devastated. Of course, there's a big slush fund. When you think about the millions of dollars being paid out to farmers because of Trump's actions, can you imagine, you know, Barack Obama got blamed for a George Bush cell phone program.
Or Solyndra.
Right.
I mean, it's possible that this guy is voting his class interests because he is a business owner and he has money.
I would imagine that if Barack Obama came up and promised the same thing as Donald Trump in terms of his class interest, he still would probably be a little bit a Trump voter. I mean, look at the way he said, who am I voting for? Who am I voting for? He didn't say, like, look at me. I drive a Cadillac. What do you think? Who do you think I'm voting for? I mean, he just told you why he's voting for Donald Trump. Because he's one of the bad guys. Get whitey.
Well, those things aren't mutually exclusive. But it does seem like the racial aggrievement is at the forefront of his mind.
I don't know.
If I had to say.
Yeah, I think that'd be a safe assessment with that guy. It's tough being white. I mean, he really seems like he's suffering under the weight of his whitehood.
I mean, people don't give that guy credit for having roomed with a colored man in college.
It's true. He went, he dormed with a colored guy.
I just want to tell him, like, you know who else is old and white and gets called names? Bernie Sanders.
There you go.
Maybe go that way.
Folks, this episode, oh, where is this? Here it is. Sun's out. Oh, I got to do that sun's out, guns out thing. Forgot about that.
Wear a tank top?
Yeah. That was...
Well, when you put it that way, it doesn't sound half as exciting.
Sun's out, but you're in. Don't get stuck in the office trying to find software, folks. Trade that office time for more beach time. and find the right software fast at Capterra.com/majority. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. It's got over 950, that's like 100, they got an extra 150,000 reviews from the last time we did this ad, I think. 950,000 reviews of products from real software users. You'll have everything you need to make an informed decision, and you can search more than 700 specific categories of software. It's nuts. Everything from project management to email marketing to yoga studio management. No matter what kind of software your business needs, Capterra makes it easy to discover the right solution fast. Look at this. I like to go through, I've mentioned this 100 times before, but I still love it. I go through these categories. They're alphabetized. This is a totally free service. You just go and you look at software. Now, as far as I know, we don't need any, but there are times I go through this, like lead generation software. Maybe we would need that. Lead management software. We don't need that. Lead nurturing software. Learning experience platform software. Lease accounting software, lease management software, legal billing software, legal calendar software, library automation software, live chat software. I wonder if they have, I mean, they have so many different mailroom management software, martial arts software, marketplace software. The point is that if you have a business, even if you don't think there's software for this, you should check this out because I have a feeling there might be.
Yeah, if you're not using software, get on it.
Museum software, music school software, network mapping, nutrition analysis software. There's so many different things here. The only problem is that whenever I look at this, it's like I have these moments where I imagine I have a different career. Like I'm working a pawn shop and there's pawn shop software or PDF software. I'm not sure how I do that. Pediatric software, don't want to deal with kids. Personalization software, pest control software, pet grooming, pet sitting, and pharmacy software. The list goes on and on. Visit Capterra.com/majority for free today and find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra.com/majority. That's Capterra, CAPTERRA.com/majority. All right, quick break, and we'll be right back with Timothy Faust.
Nobody move, there's blood on the floor. And I can't find my heart. Where did it go? Did I leave it in the cold? So please give it back, cause it's not yours to take. It must have fell when I lost my mind. Deep in the cup, drowning in pain. Somebody help, cause I can't find my way. Nobody move.
We are back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program healthcare activist and author, Health Justice of Health Justice Now, Single Payer, and What Comes Next, Timothy Faust. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, Tim, let's do this because I think to hopefully by now, much of this audience is largely familiar with the problem of our current healthcare system, at least in terms of the way they experience it, and largely familiar with the concept of a single payer Medicare for all system. But Let's review it briefly before we get into more of this. Like, what are the primary problems with our healthcare system in terms of, like, operationally now? I mean, if people experience it now, like they're out of plan or they're in plan, they've got to submit forms, they got to pay. It's super expensive. It changes all the time. But what is the fundamentals of that problem?
So there are two fundamental problems. One is that if you're an insurance company, it's just not profitable to insure sick people because sick people can be really expensive. And if you cover sick people or if you give them health care they can afford where they need it, you're going to lose a lot of money. For example, like the general statistic is that half of all medical costs are spent by 5% of the population. For example, a person with hemophilia can cost up to $1 million a year to cover. A complicated pregnancy can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to cover. And that's because, fundamental truth number two, if you're a provider like a hospital or a corporate pharmaceutical company, close personal friend Martin Shkreli, it's extremely profitable to charge as much as possible to people who are sick to receive care that they need. You've got an inelastic cost. People aren't very cost discriminatory when it's their own healthcare, and for good reason. Right. So we kind of got these two competing forces, and the end result is that insurance companies try to shift more and more of the costs of sick people, poor people, et cetera, onto the federal government while kind of squeezing the remaining healthy pool for as much money as they can get, which is why your premiums go up, your deductibles go up, and all those kinds of problems people have really felt at the pain people have felt with their insurance plan. Meanwhile, hospitals are also breaking arms and legs to make profit. In the U.S., an MRI scan costs five times more than an MRI scan in Australia, literally the same machine doing the same scan, even within the U.S. I think Sarah Cliff, formerly of Vox, and now of Washington Post, did a report showing that within the D.C. area, MRIs can vary up to seven times in price, including the same machine at the same hospital, just based on whose insurance company was paying for that. So you've got massive cost discrepancies, no regulatory power, insurance companies need hospitals way more than hospitals need insurance companies. So they're committing extortion. Insurance companies are rational profit-seeking actors, so they pass on that extortion onto you, the consumer, and the whole thing's rotten from top to tip.
Now, that figure, and I've heard in the past 20% of the people bear 80% of the cost. But if it's 5% that costs 50% of our healthcare costs, I mean, I feel like that's like a business I could even run, where it's just like, it's so clear what I need to do is not insure those five people. I mean, those 5% Absolutely. Of the people. I mean, if I just got to get the other 95%. And then if I can eliminate the 20%, I could be insuring people if I have the proper information for something that I know they're not going to need. And that is, that to me is, sounds like a great business, unless you're actually the customer in that instance.
Right. It's very easy to insure sick people who never go to the hospital and never see a doctor.
And, you know, and everything I think we've heard about, Wendell Potter, I think most famously left that business and has been beating this drum for quite a while. And to a large extent, I think there was a sense prior to the ACA that we could have had a Medicare buy-in at age 55, largely because the industry understood that their business model could not work. And if they could offload people 10 years younger than they are now and when they are eligible for Medicare, they could offload a significant percentage of people who have more likely to be ill to help their business. So, okay. So these are the core problems we have on one hand. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the hospital end of it. Okay. Because the insurance end of it seems pretty straightforward. I mean, it is a completely unnecessary player in this mix. What on the hospital end, how would we do? Well, all right, man, I don't want to get ahead of myself here. So talk about what needs to happen to deal with both ends of that problem.
So you pool all the money we currently spend on healthcare into, we build one universal risk pool administered by a public entity that has a mandate to cover in full all care for all people. You build a single payer. And the single payer can do a lot of things that these fragmented insurers can't do. We know that, and I'm sure your listeners are familiar with how Medicare gets to basically set its prices that, it's willing to pay. Now, how it sets those prices is, of course, tainted by groups like the AMA, who have a larger than necessary role in
determining prices. I'm sorry, Tim, you're breaking up a little bit. Tell us again, though, how does Medicare set those prices?
So Medicare gets to say, hey, we're willing to pay $5 for a Band-Aid, $30,000 for a hip replacement. And these, of course, these prices are wildly, I'm making them up right now,
right.
Probably more like $8,000 for hip replacement. We're willing to pay that, take it or leave it. And because Medicare covers 44 million people, suddenly the hospitals need Medicare way more than they need your random smaller insurer, and they got to take these prices. They say, okay, we will accept your billing scheme, and we will incorporate it into our hospital. And then they turn around and bill private insurers at a multiple of that Medicare cost. They'll bill at 3 times Medicare, 5 times Medicare, 7 times Medicare to your Blue Crosses, your Aetnas, your whomever's. So Medicare acts as an anchor on prices. What a single payer can do is use that negotiating power, but on behalf of 330 million people instead of 44 million people. So it gets to basically say, okay, in the U.S., a knee replacement is worth $7,000 or whatever. And hospitals can take it or leave it, and they're, generally speaking, all going to take it. All of a sudden, you create negotiating power that drives costs down. And Medicare can also look out to make sure that regional hospitals, smaller hospitals, are getting adequate funding. I believe Jayapal's plan includes a thing like global budgets, in which the Medicare for All says, okay, we're going to spend $3.7 trillion this year or $2.9 trillion this year, and we're going to allocate it to hospitals in these ways to make sure they can keep the lights on. But suddenly you've got monopsony, which is a kind of a monopoly in purchasing power, and that lets you do a whole lot more things to affect cost than what we can do right now.
Okay, so we've got this monopsony that the buyer, the consumers of health care have, as sort of funneled through the single payer system, the Medicare system. And just to be clear, when we hear Medicare for All, these proposals are not really Medicare as we know it now, right? I mean, it's really almost more like Medicaid for All.
Yes, Medicare right now is premiums, it is cost sharing, it has deductibles. If you go to, unless you have supplemental insurance, you go to the hospital under Medicare, you're paying 20% of the bill, which is, of course, unacceptable. Medicare also has Medicare Advantage, which is a private carve-out for privately administered Medicare plans, which is extremely profitable, but not great for people who need medical care. They churn it out, I think, at 3 times the rate as they buy into these plans. So now we're looking for an improved Medicare for All that removes all cost sharing and covers all people, including people who aren't citizens.
Okay, so the what do you do when you have – so you have this monopsony. What do you do when you have the problem of hospital consolidation? So a monopsony works if you're going in and I, as a buyer, have multiple options as to who I'm going to buy from, right? So Medicare can go into a – a place like maybe like New York City and say, we're going to give you these rates. If you don't want these rates, we're just going to send all our patients to a different hospital. What if I'm going into something that's more rural? What if one company has bought up all the hospitals? I mean, what do we do in that instance of that type of consolidation?
That's a great question. And that's a pretty real concern. I think there are two things a single payer can do. One is a single payer can say to that consolidator company, if you treat anybody outside of the Medicare for All, you don't get any Medicare for All money, and kind of leverage the fact that these companies are spread across the entire U.S. To guarantee that if they want to get the money in Philadelphia, they got to play nice in outside Pittsburgh. Secondly, I think a single payer is uniquely poised among all American programs to invest in reopening rural clinics. And either administering them directly, or which is what I'd prefer, or are contracting them off, because there are massive provider shortages in rural areas, a lot of which have been spurred on by the lack of Medicaid funds available in those places because of lack of Medicaid expansion. But I think a single payer is forced to consider the question of, okay, do we just open our own clinics to take care of people? And I think that's, to me, a really interesting option.
So wait a second, though. I mean, it seems to me, like, okay, so we can leverage it if they are taking they're taking patients in an area where there's more competition. But let's say I'm a hedge funder and I'm like, all I need to do is go in and get, buy up all the hospitals within, big rural swaths where I am, I am the only place where you can get medical care in these areas. It seems to me that we're going to need some type of legislation, right? Some type of antitrust legislation that is going to prohibit, because our monopsony does not work if we bump up against the monopoly, or, because at that point, the single payer is responsible for people who theoretically have a shorter time horizon, because they need healthcare immediately or over time. I mean, so there has to be a more robust answer for that, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you want to stick within the single payer, then I think you got the options that I provided. But I think there is there can be a larger movement to break up these hospital trusts. I think there's a lot of hospital consolidation has really wreaked havoc in a lot of quarters, even in urban areas. I think Pittsburgh is a great example of how hospital consolidation through UPMC has ruined both healthcare and labor, or really, really damaged a lot of workers in the Pittsburgh area. I think a larger movement towards breaking up the hospitals, towards breaking up the hospital providers, towards breaking up the financial services firms that see people's well-being as an investment vehicle is essential. I don't think single payer can solve that by itself. There's a lot of things single payer can
right.
do.
Okay.
But I think the movement which demands single payer can also demand antitrust legislation.
All right, fair enough. And so let's talk about the question of private insurance. A lot has been made of this. What is the principle here, or I should say, sort of structurally speaking, what is the problem with private insurance?
It's inefficient and it costs a lot. It costs a lot more to insure somebody privately than it does through a larger risk pool, through a larger single payer or a thing like Medicare, even Medicaid. And they lose a bunch of money because they want to offload sick people. It results in worse outcomes.
Okay, no, but what I mean is in the context of we set up a single payer system. Everybody's paying their taxes into this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And employers are paying taxes. Maybe middle-class folks are paying more in taxes. Wealthy people paying, hopefully, much more in taxes. The net to society, as we know, is going to actually be we're gonna save money as a society on healthcare, and as individuals, I would imagine the vast majority of us, well over the vast majority of us, are going to be saving money net in terms of what we pay for healthcare over the course of our life versus what we'll pay in taxes. If that is the case, is there a problem? If somebody goes out there and says, well, I'm starting a private insurance company, why would we care as long as people have to pay their taxes and they can't opt out of the risk pool? I don't know why somebody would start a private insurance company, but if they did, what difference would it make, or would it?
So ultimately, that results in stratified care, which there's a track for the private wealthy who are probably buying the private insurance. And there's a separate track of care offered for people on the public plan. A great example of this is South Africa. South Africa has a kind of two-stream model, which there is a public plan everyone buys into. But if you've got the money, you pull out and you can buy a private insurance plan. And that gets you private insurance coverage, which is much more expensive at hospitals. But that means maybe you get a private room, or you get VIP treatment, or you get certain kinds of things that you want access to, kind of the luxury model. And the result is that in South Africa, I think it's 16% of the population spends 43% of healthcare costs, and that population is predominantly white and predominantly wealthy. It kind of created actual like medical apartheid in South Africa all over again. Whenever you have a kind of duplicative insurance model, it's going to tilt towards favoring people who have money, who will get...
Tim, I'm sorry. We lost you again. You there? I'm sorry. We lost you.
Yeah.
We lost you right after you said, whenever you have a duplicative model.
Yeah, you're gonna have people receiving luxury, people receiving private luxury care at the expense of the public option and the public model.
How does that come at the expense of the public model? Just because people, doctors will take themselves out of the public program because there's enough money there in the private one?
Yeah, you create options, you create facilities just for private, just for private insurance, because hospitals can bill the private insurers more because they don't have any cost and powers.
And do you think that we would, I mean, let me put it this way. Like, from my perspective, I don't see that as we have as much of an opportunity for that type of problem as South Africa does, right? I mean, for some fairly obvious reasons, it seems to me. I mean, in South Africa, you've literally had a dual track society for decades. And in this country, there's certainly been, we already have that sort of high end wealthy stuff, but there's just not enough of those people. Is there? For them to drain that much resources out of the system?
I mean, I hope not, but I also don't want to find out.
Right. I guess from my perspective, from a political standpoint, I can't help but wonder if that's not a decent trade-off. But
we can't legislate away people providing supplemental insurance, right? Like, we can't... stop insurance companies from existing to sell insurance on top of the single payer. That doesn't duplicate any of the existing single payer insurance coverages. And I think that will probably still exist, and that will go to predominantly wealthy people. I don't quite know what it'll cover, but that will surely exist after a single payer is passed. And okay. That is a thing that I don't love, but don't think we can stop.
Okay. So when we talk about that supplemental insurance, that's if they want private rooms or, I guess cosmetic surgery or, something like along those lines. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Things not covered by the single payer.
And so...
Because both Jayapal and Bernie's bills include a provision that... No provider can provide care to a person not covered under a single payer that is covered under a single payer.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So if I'm going in and I'm getting, any number of any type of treatments, if I'm going in to check and see if I have a heart attack, there, I can't have a private insurance that will cover that because it's going to be covered under Medicare.
Right.
Okay. And... how localized will these programs be? In other words, it's one thing to sort of say that Medicare sets the rates, or how will this money be distributed? What would be the mechanism here?
Well, I can tell you what I want. There hasn't been a whole lot of in the Jayapal and Sanders bills. There hasn't been a whole lot of here's actually how we pass up the money, but I can tell you what they indicate and what I think is totally essential to having a good single payer program, which is you want the money allocated as close to the ground as possible, simply because healthcare needs are very different from place to place. Healthcare needs in Manhattan and Brooklyn are different. Healthcare needs in Brooklyn and Birmingham are different. Healthcare needs in Birmingham and, I don't know, Boise and Dallas and Las Vegas are all very different from each other. So you want to have a healthcare model which determines how to spend money and where to spend money and what programs to fund that is as close to the ground as you can get, which is kind of a model off the Medicaid program and some of the individual Medicaid grants that have been investigated or explored over the past decade. You want to set a standard for these things are covered that is set at the federal level and make sure all the financing is federal, because if financing is local, you run into problems. Even a little bit of a cost borne by the state becomes a great way to begin excluding care. But I think you want to let regional organizations determine how you invest money in local ways, whether it's approving new programs for housing or for food, experimental programs for coordinating care, or hiring social workers to work on pregnant people, applying for new money to try new kinds of programs that can then be shared across the rest of the country. I believe Jayapal's plan does include a local component. It includes local assemblies and local councils, although they don't really define what local means. It could be state by state. It could be even smaller than that.
Let's talk a little bit about long-term care, because as it stands now, I don't think most people know this, but like two-thirds of people who are in nursing homes are there via Medicaid. And it varies state to state, but the rules for Medicaid eligibility for elderly people are really draconian in a way.
Absolutely.
You need to be down to your last $2,000 in assets. You get to keep a car, but if you have a home, that cuts against it. I mean, it depends, I think, state to state. Am I right?
Yes. In some states, I think in most states, Medicaid can put a lien on your house so long as you're in long-term care, if you're in it for over 9 months, I believe.
And then what it does is it basically says you got to sell your house, you got to pay us off this amount. I think it's something like $11,000 a month. And so basically you have to spend down all your money before. And in some states, I think, like, even if you give, let's say, $5,000 to your kids or something like that at that point, the state claws that back if you have given it within the 5 years prior to going into a nursing home, is my understanding.
That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I've met folks who had to get divorced and able to afford long-term care, because this affects people with disabilities as well, who need long-term care for most of their lives. And it's absolutely barbaric. Part of that is because Medicaid is sponsored by the state, and states are very cost sensitive. They don't have a lot of money, relatively speaking, compared to the federal government. And so they try to find ways to determine, like, who's really worth spending money on. It's means testing. It's means testing weaponized to really affect the most vulnerable people in America. And long-term care is health care. Long-term care must be paid for at the federal level, no questions asked. Because we know what's better and cheaper, which is often, for a lot of folks, home health care.
Right.
People can receive the same standard of care in their homes. It's more humane. Home is where your dog lives. Home is where your family can visit you. But instead, we force them into nursing homes. Now, a lot of that is because of corruption. In Arkansas, I believe, a state rep was found to be on the payroll of a nursing home. And surprise, surprise, he pushed for a nursing home-friendly Medicaid legislation. You see that also in
all right,
Iowa.
I want to just be explicit about this. So there's two options, right, that people have mm-hmm. when they get older. One is they can get a visiting nurse who will come, you know, X amount of hours per day, X amount of days per week to make sure that people are eating or they're taking their medication or that, you know, check their vitals to see how they're doing. Or if you're, you know, you're concerned about your parents and that maybe they're not eating or maybe they're not taking their medication or they're deteriorating because of these things, you put them into a nursing home. Nursing home is obviously far more profitable for somebody than than home care. And so the money basically steps back and says, we're going to manipulate the system so that the system does not pay for home care because we're injecting our profit motive into the public goods system, essentially.
Yes. In fact, home care often has to be, you could say, opted into by a state. The default model is nursing homes or SNFs, which is bad. It's awful. Home health is a form of agency. It's a form of independent living. And that we deny it to people who are old and people of disabilities is really shameful. I met people in, Tennessee, who had to move to Colorado because Colorado has home health for people on Medicaid, whereas Tennessee doesn't. So people had to leave their families and friends and loved ones behind just to go get a chance to live a life that was fair and just to them. And so, like, we understand that home health is a cheaper, better option. It's more humane. It's more cost efficient. We also severely underpay home health aides in the U.S., but paying them $15 an hour instead of $11 an hour isn't going to break the bank relative to nursing homes, but we refuse to do it. A single payer, right now both the Jayapal and finally the Sanders plans as of April have agreed that long-term care is part of the single payer plan and must be covered in full for all people who need it.
All right. So let me ask you this. Who takes the hit? I mean, let's go. Somebody's going to nursing homes will take a bit of a hit in this instance where, we rationally give care as opposed to based upon who has the largest profit motive and the ability to lobby the hardest to get that money redistributed to them. But who else in this context? I mean, let's go through some of the different people. Like, one of the things that we hear often is you can't get rid of the private insurance industry because you'll be kicking anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million people out of their jobs. What do you say to that critique?
Well, that estimate of 500,000 people is wildly inflated. To 1 million people is wildly inflated. There's a lot of conflation of healthcare staff with insurance staff. But I've got a couple of things on that. One is that a lot of the jobs people do in insurance will still be needed under a single payer. A lot of the infrastructure of how do you put together a claims pipeline or how do you talk to a hospital still exists. But secondly, I think there's a lot of chances for the single payer to create jobs. The single payer has to create jobs. We have not created nearly enough jobs that we need to actually take care of people long term. And most of the folks who work in insurance probably work in a call center or work as a nurse, chasing down hospitals, talking to hospitals. Actually, I've got an example of a kind of labor that a single payer is poised to create. That's an example of kinds of jobs available to people to transfer to from insurance. It's the idea of the medical legal partnership. Medical legal partnership is a Medicaid clinic. There's a bunch of them in the U.S. I know of one of them in Boston that I visited a couple times, in which a social worker helps people both get medical and legal care. If somebody comes in and their kid has asthma, social worker does an intake and says, okay, yep, this kid has asthma. Let's get this person medical care. But at the same time, the social worker recognizes that asthma in kids is often caused by home conditions. The social worker says, for example, what's your home like? Is there mold? Is there water in the walls? What's going on? Yes, it does. Okay, let's bring you down to a lawyer. Here's all the information for the lawyer because you and I have a lot of civic protections against the things that make us sick, but you only have access to those if you have representation or if you have the time and fluency to do it yourself. The social worker coordinates that care. The person gets a letter threatening to sue the landlord unless the home's run up to back the code, and it is, and the person gets better care. This kind of social worker has a valuable function, which is to find people all the care they are entitled to. And if right now, if you work in insurance, your job is primarily to find people the minimum amount of care you're required to give them, right? How do we kind of whittle down the hospitals, the providers, the treatment that we can give this person? A single payer is finally incentivized to invest in this like more empathetic model of health in which social workers find more people, more care for more people. And that's these kinds of jobs must be created across the spectrum, whether it's patient advocates in hospitals, social workers who run essential programs, and that's a natural fit for one or the other. And the Sanders plan and the Jayapal plan both include, I think, $5 billion in job training and job replacement for people in the insurance industry. But there's going to be a lot of folks who need to stay in to keep the lights on. Either we nationalize healthcare, we got to build our own infrastructure, and then other folks, there's a lot of jobs just begging to be filled in a more just healthcare model.
I don't know, but it strikes me as one of the greatest gifts we could give to someone who's been working at an insurance company whose job it is to deny claims, to give them the opportunity to basically go and help patients rather than curtail their ability to access healthcare. I'm just guessing off the top of my head that would be a massive benefit to those folks. All right, well, let's talk about doctors, because if we have a monopsony and it functions properly, maybe we've got to kneecap the hospitals a little bit. Obviously, hospitals are going to be losers. But when we say hospitals are losers, we're talking about shareholders in hospitals who are taking a hit not anybody who's necessarily working there, but I would imagine too, we're going to be hurting, at least in terms of financial, like some of the people who are doctors are going to lose, right? They're just not going to be, we're not going to have millionaire doctors.
Well, I think doctors come into two very broadly lumped categories. You've got your primary care doctors and you've got your specialists. And specialists are the ones that make the most money. And there's, of course, like there's a gradation there, even among specialists. You've got some that make millions and some that make only, you know, $400,000, $500,000 a year. You know, woe upon them. I think right now, specialists have really tilted the game in their favor. Right now, the board, which helps Medicare set its prices, has, for example, one primary care provider and five different kinds of hand surgeons to represent the breadth of hand surgery. And so as a result, it tends to tilt reimbursement models in favor of specialists. And so I think maybe, yeah, some of these hyper wealthy, hyper specialists might see a hit in their reimbursement rates. But I think we will see a revaluation of primary care. Because really, primary care is the thing that drives long-term health. I don't just mean preventive care in the sense of like, oh, you take care of people now and they'll be healthier in the future. I mean like the kind, empathetic work of providing people health care as, you know, as close to the person as possible is what actually makes a difference in people's long-term health outcomes. And right now, primary care has been utterly devalued. I think there's a parallel fight, not kind of like the one for antitrust legislation that we got to pursue along with a single payer, and that's free medical training for doctors, nurses, home health aides, et cetera. Because right now, you go to med school, you come out with $300,000 in debt, and you look at your job prospects, and it becomes way more tempting to go into being a cardiologist or a hand surgeon or whatever, where you can pay off your student loans, than it is to become a primary care provider or a rural healthcare provider, right? I'm meeting doctors in rural areas who can't afford to retire because nobody can afford to replace them, because it doesn't pay any money to go be a doctor outside Lexington, Kentucky, for example. And so I think if we really want to kind of seed the earth with doctors and make sure those doctors are reimbursed fairly, we got to also fight for free medical training.
And that's not involved in anybody's plan right now, is there?
No, it is not. But I think it's the kind of thing that's got to be addressed.
And so if I heard you correctly, there's going to be some specialists are going to get paid less. And some primary care physicians are going to get paid more. On balance, though, there has to be less, right? I mean, if we're gonna take, I guess maybe 15 cents of the dollar out of the equation in terms of it being single payer and there not being a profit motive, probably a little bit more in that context. And we're gonna probably pick up some money in terms of just general efficiencies. But there's got to be some money that comes out of the pockets of doctors too, right?
I don't know. There's a lot of bloat and a lot of fraud in hospitals and healthcare corporations. I mean, just the fact that there are skyscrapers of billing departments in cities across the U.S., like in Connecticut, kind of indicates where a lot of that money is going. Certainly, there needs to be a course correction in some doctor salaries. But I don't think it's going to be quite as catastrophic as some might fear.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but I think the scale of the grift in corporate healthcare is staggering.
I think that's the important thing to keep in mind here. It is stunning. Lastly, let's just talk about what you argue single payer will lead to, because it's interesting. Once the U.S. government, once we as a society have a, and this is where almost the skin of the game in the game sort of equation is turned on its head. Once it's really society, we clearly, the cost of keeping people healthy becomes clear to society. That's going to incentivize society getting involved in a lot of things that drive health outcomes.
Absolutely. One, if your people get sick because they don't have safe housing or they don't have any housing at all, or their housing is flammable or full of mold, and so they die or they get very, very sick with long-term conditions, then all of a sudden healthcare spending becomes housing spending, and you build long-term social housing to bring healthcare costs down. and people get sick because they don't have access to healthy food to eat, so they get diabetes or comorbidities like cardiac failure, then food is healthcare. And you got to invest in food, safe, affordable, free food options to bring healthcare costs down. Right now, nobody is accountable for all the kinds of, we call them social determinants of care.
Oh, we lost you for a second.
You understand that healthcare happens. Sorry.
Go ahead. Nobody. You said nobody's responsible for the, what did you call it? Socially determinant what?
Social determinants of health.
Okay.
Is the medical policy lingo form. But we understand most healthcare happens outside the hospital. It's where you live. It's what you eat. It's are you safe? It's do you have money? It's do you have community? These are the things that really drive people's long-term health. But right now, nobody's profiting off of them, so nobody invests in them, so people get sick and die. My belief is that once we force the single payer to bear the costs of providing care and bear the costs of what happened when care is not provided, it can finally be incentivized and forced to reckon with all these kinds of long-term suffering and long-term health conditions.
Once we basically say that society is responsible, at least for making sure that everybody's healthy, there's like a cascading effect, one hopes anyways. Let me ask you just one last question, just basically because of what's in the news today. The administration has basically set up a new set of rules to assess whether an immigrant can get a green card or should be eligible for citizenship, et cetera, if you have used Medicaid in the past that can hurt your eligibility for citizenship or a green card, apparently, is my understanding. I mean, it was just announced this morning. But what happens if I'm living in this country, I'm undocumented, maybe I'm my family is are all U.S. citizens, but I'm the dad, I came in late, or I'm the mom, I came in late, or I'm a child and I came in late, and I don't use Medicaid. What happens when I get sick? Do I just stay in my house and die? What happens in terms of, like, what does society pay for?
Right now, or...
Let's just assume I decided not to use Medicaid.
I mean, right now, if somebody gets sick, they go out and they try to do their best while they're sick out in the world. Maybe they get other people sick. They suffer. They get long-term conditions that drive them into further long-term conditions. There's a lot of spending. There's a lot of debt. There's a lot of pain. Denying people health care when they need it, like creating those kinds of means testing, kind of harkens back to American health care when it was racially segregated and it was rationed by race. We're kind of bringing that back and doing that again. No, it's utterly barbaric and fundamentally inhumane to deny people health care they need.
And ultimately, society will end up paying the cost in some fashion, won't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, like a person being sick has a long-term cost. I mean, also, there's the pragmatic view, which I find a little gross, which is that the labor of undocumented people is already being exploited and therefore subsidizing much of the wealth of this country, and you're letting your own workforce get sick. But I prefer the more, I think, humanistic argument.
Were it so that everyone in this country did.
me too.
Tim Faust, the book is Health Justice Now, Single Payer and What Comes Next. Thanks so much for all of your information and the work that you're doing. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank y'all for having me. Really appreciate it.
All right, we're going to put a link to this book on majority.fm, Health Justice Now, Single Payer and What Comes Next. You can hear Tim Faust. A lot of times he's on Chapo. And he's going around the country. I think he's still barnstorming, basically, a lot of DSA events.
I saw him at one last year in Williamsburg, actually.
In Greenpoint.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I helped put that thing together, actually, and Tim came and spoke at it, and it was very nice.
Well, look at that. You two should meet each other.
Me and who?
You and Jamie.
Oh, hi, Jamie.
There you go. What a coincidence. Good stuff. And I think... I don't know if you can find, but I'm sure DSA has a breakdown of where he's giving his talks and whatnot, right?
Oh, yeah. He's also got some really cool T-shirts for sale that he sells. I'm a fan
of... Like healthcare T-shirts?
Yeah, they're like heavy metal t-shirts about healthcare.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I like the one that says abortion is healthcare. I might get one of those.
That does sound like a good one. Folks, sun's out, but you're in. Don't get stuck in the office trying to find software. Trade that office time for more beach time using Capterra, the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 950,000 reviews of products from real software users in more than 700 specific categories of software, you'll have everything you need to make an informed decision. Visit Capterra.com/majority for free today. Find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's Capterra.com/majority. Just a reminder, this program exists because of your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get extra content nearly every single day of the year. I mean, business days. We take a couple of days off from that, but literally a couple. And you also are supporting the free show. And, you know, every now and then, like maybe once every, 24 to 36 months, we give a super, super bonus to members. I don't know what that would be, but we're going to try and we're rolling out all sorts of new things. I think we're going to give like member benefits on the calls, like the member line or something like that. We're still working on the technology to do something like that. But nevertheless, become a member today. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, check out the AM Quickie. People are loving it.
I listened to it on the way into work this morning.
Did you?
Yeah, to catch up because I did not follow the news really at all once Epstein died.
There you go. That's exactly why I wanted to do this. And when we're on vacation at the end of the month, we have all new interviews, but we won't have the news of the day. And we will have the AM Quickie. Yeah. So maybe what we'll do, even we'll put maybe one on the Monday show. Or no, it'll be in the feed. When we do the intros for that, we'll remind people to go check it out. Let's remember to do that. AM Quickie, it's available in your feed. Come September, we're going to go off on its own separate feed. And we're trying to figure out whether or not we'll do that, probably even for members, because this is this is a new product. And we're going to roll it out and put it in on its own feed. So check that out, the AM Quickie. And also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Supposedly, Mike will be back tomorrow from his global jaunt in time for TMBS, but we'll see. We'll see tomorrow. Jamie, you're here. The Antifada.
Here I am. So this week on the Antifada, we have Simone Norman, who you may know from the hilarious Praxis video that was going around. We're recording tonight, actually. We're going to have a little girls chat. We're going to talk about irony, humor, and its role in the left and the role that it should not play in the left. So I'm excited about that. Also, from last week, we have a brand new episode of Vampire Castle, wherein I talk with Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session about actual vampires. And this one, we talked about the very funny TV show, What We Do in the Shadows. Also, still good from last week, Sean and Andy talk about the Manson murders and lay out a very convincing parapolitical case for the government's involvement in said murders.
Hmm. So to cover for Michael, tomorrow night, it looks like we'll have Elaine Yu of Agence France-Presse, AFP. That was like a French pronunciation. I went for it there. And she's going to be talking about what's going on in Hong Kong, which looks crazy right now.
I saw a tweet from, I'm going to butcher her name, Zeynep Tufekci.
Zeynep Tufekci, yes. Yeah.
And she's there. And she said the airport does not, it does not feel like all of Hong Kong is nuts right now. Like, it's, we're seeing footage. She's at the airport. I don't know. It's worth checking that out. But Nevertheless, I mean, that's the way it is. I mean, you have functioning societies in the middle of civil wars.
I saw a bunch of trucks. There's a video out that we played in the fun half of just a line of cargo trucks like getting into formation as if they're going to try to like start clearing people out of the airport. Oh, maybe. Jesus.
Damn.
But go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, and Patreon members of Literary Hangover will have gotten George Orwell's essay, A Hanging. We listened to the full thing and talked about it and talked about, spilled the tea on his dad, who was an imperial policeman in the British Raj, specifically the opium department.
Whoa.
Which is...
Man, things starting to come into clarity now. Now I understand what's going on.
Yeah, well, it's like those very hands-on, those policemen were like, got to make sure the grow operation's going well. And that accounted for 1/6 of the Britain's revenue from India, selling opium to Chinese addicts, basically.
Jesus.
So we get into that.
All right. Gonna take a quick break, head into the fun half, and see you there. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.